We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. Today's guest is Katie Milkman, Wharton University professor and author of national bestseller, How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. The book was named one of the top 8 books for healthy living in 2021 by the New York Times. Katie has devoted her career to the study of behavior change, and that is a good thing, since she shares that 40% of premature deaths are actually due to behaviors and habits we can change. Today, she talks about the importance of understanding the barriers that stand between you and the change you're trying to make so that you can find the right solution to each particular roadblock. Turning an uphill battle into a downhill one is one of the keys to success, but there are plenty. She goes through the most common barriers, which are short-term rewards or instant gratification, procrastination, forgetfulness, and to hear others, stay tuned. Now, here's Katie. Katie, it's great to have you on Untangle today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited.
So in your book, you say that you've spent most of your career focused on habit change. And I am really curious what inspired this focus for you.
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. It took a little while for me to get extremely focused on this topic. I was definitely a wanderer for a bit as a researcher, and the science I was doing as an assistant professor was really all over the place, from looking at race and gender bias in organizations to trying to understand what kinds of articles go viral on the New York Times website to what movies do we rent and hold. So I wasn't focused. And then I wandered over to a lecture at the medical school at the University of Pennsylvania, where I work, by a group in that area who was studying medical decision making and trying to improve the choices people make about their health. I thought, look, this looks interesting. I'm interested in lots of things related to how people make choices. Maybe I'll learn something. And there was a slide. I am such a nerd. It had a graph on it, and it changed my life. The graph was a breakdown of the percentage of premature deaths in the US that are caused by different things. So it had some of your usual suspects, like genetic causes, accidents, environmental toxins, a whole long list of reasons we don't make it as long as we'd like to. One of the wedges on the graph was a pie chart, was decisions we could change about what we eat, what we drink, whether we smoke, whether or not we practice safety when we get into vehicles, those daily choices we make that have a big impact on our lifespan. And I thought, okay, that's going to matter. But what blew my mind is how much. It was 40%. The biggest wedge in this graph, 40% of premature deaths in the US are due to behaviors we could change. And that changed my life because I was, I'll say, casually studying these topics occasionally. And when I realized what a huge opportunity there was to expand the human lifespan, to make the world truly a better place through science, I really focused my work around behavior change.
There's been so much written on this, and a lot of it has been
similar, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But can you just give an overview? You're a behavioral scientist, and I'm curious how you describe what is behavioral science. And then in your book, you also talk about behavioral economics. So can you just give us a context for what are these things?
Yeah. So I'm a behavioral scientist, which means that I study how decisions are made, and I do it by conducting rigorous scientific experiments to understand if we change this one thing, how will that change someone's choices? And behavioral science is really the study of how people make decisions. Behavioral economics is a subfield of behavioral science, and it's a subfield in which economists try to model the kinds of choices that are being made and explore how that might shape policy decisions. It's part of behavioral science, but it's only one part. There's also psychologists who do research in this area, sociologists, computer scientists, and we all bring our own lens to it. And my training is interdisciplinary, so I don't really identify with one segment of the behavioral science world.
And you say in the beginning of the book, you can follow the generally accepted advice, set tough goals, break them down, visualize success, take small steps. Most of what I've read about habit change falls under that category. But then your concept is that we are much better with change if we can isolate the actual weakness, which you call the opponent inside your head, that is preventing the problem, and then you pounce on that. So we're going to get into the different opponents in a bit because I'd like to go through each of them. But what do you mean by that? And do you think our standard beliefs about habit change work, but this theory works better? Or what has been your research on this?
I think there's a lot of great advice and lots of great science that's been done on habits. And there's a fair amount of received wisdom that is useful on average, whether it's about setting goals and breaking big things down. Those things help. There's no question. What I think is missing, and what I'm trying to share with a wider audience through my book, through conversations like this one, is that research shows we can do better than just improving outcomes on average, because sometimes we can understand what is the specific barrier an individual is facing to change and tailor the solution, and that we can do better than a one-size-fits-all strategy, and we can get better results. And some of the common barriers that I know we're going to get into, they really are quite different. And what you'd want to do to overcome them if they're standing in your way is going to be really distinct. So let me give you the example of confidence. If you're not making change because you don't believe you can, you need a really different set of solutions than if you're not making change because you find the experience unpleasant or because you keep forgetting. Those are all distinct reasons a person might not be succeeding when they have a big goal or when they want to create a new habit. But if it's confidence, you need something different than if it's no fun or if it's you just can't remember to get around to it. It doesn't seem like it should be rocket science, but we get it wrong consistently in the way that we try to make change in our own lives and the way that we try to deploy change in others and organizations when we're coaching, teaching, mentoring. And so I wrote this book and I'm having these kinds of conversations to try to make sure that more people understand both the science and what it says about strategies that can work and the importance of matching the different solutions that have been studied to your personal situation.
Let's say I'm trying to eat more healthy foods. One of your reflections that you would want me to do is you say, identify your adversaries that are thwarting your progress. How does one, or how would I in that situation determine whether I'm lazy or I just don't know enough about healthy foods? Or you talk about the right thing is also unsatisfying in the short term. And we all have this present bias, our tendency to favor what's instantly yummy over a long-term reward, which might be a healthier mind and body. How do I reflect on this to really understand? I mean, some people are highly self-aware, but others might not be able to break down what those actual adversaries are. And they might call it something like, I just don't have good willpower.
Absolutely. And by the way, that is a super common catch-all explanation that we offer. Like, oh, I just can't resist. I don't have the strength of will. It's a great question. How do you figure out what is it specifically that you are facing that's keep holding you back? And I think the answer is often, by the way, there's a common enemy when there's a specific goal. So when it comes to eating, there's some pretty common answers. And so tailoring can be as simple in that context as understanding, oh, it's eating. That's where my goals lie versus something else like getting a recommended cancer screening. And that's my, I need to follow through with taking my medications, or I need to follow through with doing my meditation practice. So there are some common enemies and you can zoom in on those. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the common enemies for eating. But then once you zoomed in the common enemies, it's normally pretty straightforward to see which one does apply to you once you understand what they are. So when it comes to eating, I think common enemies are, you've pointed to a bunch of them. One of them is it's not fun in the moment. It's unpleasant in the moment. So we have a tendency as humans to be present biased, which means we overvalue the instant gratification we get from our choices. And we tend to undervalue the long-term rewards. And so this helps explain why we smoke, why we don't save enough for retirement, why we eat donuts when we mean to be eating salads. So this instant gratification challenge is a really big one for food. Another big one for food is, as you pointed to, habit. So I have a set of things I eat pretty much every day for breakfast, every day for lunch. We tend to be a little bit more habituated earlier in the day. There's really interesting research on this by my colleague, Jonah Berger at the Wharton School. And then we seek variety more in the evenings and later meals. So breakfast is one that like most people have the same thing every day. Lunch, again, a lot of consistency there. So those are big opportunities, actually, if you are a habitual eater in those spaces, to try to make a replacement plan and build a replacement habit. Because again, it's going to be on autopilot once you do it for so many of us. And if you see yourself in that and you're like, yeah, I do basically eat the same breakfast every day, or on weekdays, I always eat the same thing or something like that, then habit is probably part of the solution. And thinking about habit changes will be effective. Then it's not only about impulsivity. And then there can be other barriers, certainly, to healthy eating. Like maybe you don't have the knowledge you need, and that can be fairly quickly and easily remedied. Thankfully, we have wonderful tools like Google that can teach us about the nutritional value of different meals. We also have friends and family who we may know and other acquaintances who have better eating habits, and we might need to just do a little bit of asking to try to learn from other people. And social information can be incredibly powerful and useful when we're trying to figure out something that'll work for us. Finding someone who resembles you, who you can relate to, you can ask how they're getting better results in a setting, can be really important. So if there's an information gap, often it's better answered by a peer when it comes to behavior change. Anyway, I'm a professor. I'm in favor of asking experts when it comes to things that require expertise. But when it comes to what meals are you finding work for you on the go, given our shared lifestyle and are keeping you feeling like you have the energy you need, but also like you're getting the nutrients you want, that can be really useful rather than going to experts.
But you would still need willpower, or would you call it something else? Because you talk about building a replacement plan. So you have to somewhere along the line change your intention or change your reward need for instant gratification. In that moment, it is going to take willpower. Because if you change your breakfast from a donut to a hard-boiled egg, you still need to go through that process of, this isn't as much fun to have a hard-boiled egg, but I'm going to do it. There has to be a sense of intention and follow through that requires a level of willpower. Yeah.
Anytime you make a change there, you need to be actively attempting that change. You need to be involved. It isn't complete autopilot, but you can make it a lot easier than it would be if you're just saying like, I'm going to try to do the right thing from now on. That's hard, as opposed to, well, okay, let's think a little bit about the obstacles to your plan. One of the obstacles is going to be that if you've decided a hard-boiled egg is what you want to substitute for your morning donut, are there going to be donuts in the house? And are you going to have to resist that temptation? Or are they going to be on your walk to work? And are you going to have to resist that temptation? And do you actually like the hard-boiled egg? Or will you eat it and still be hungry and want the donut afterwards? So you need to think about what are the barriers and try to eliminate them on the path. As I said, one of the big ones is it's not as fun and it's not as sating, enjoyable in so many ways to eat the hard-boiled egg. So most people, when they have a goal, they think, let me look for the most direct route from point A to point B, where B is my goal and A is where I am. And research by Ayelet Fishbach at the University of Chicago and Caitlin Woolley of Cornell University actually shows that's a mistake to look for that efficient route because it neglects the importance of fun on the journey. A very small fraction of people choose to pursue goals in ways that are less efficient, but more enjoyable, and they tend to persist longer. And when people are nudged towards choosing a more fun path to a goal rather than a more efficient path, they have better outcomes again, because they stick to it. So then the question is like, is a hard-boiled egg fun? It might be, I don't know your taste. For me, it might be that I need to substitute something a little bit, maybe slightly worse for me, but still a step better than the donut. So maybe it's that I need toast with cream cheese, or maybe I need a smoothie every morning that's delicious, but more nutritionally valuable than a donut. And thinking about what are you going to actually enjoy? Okay, maybe if you have some goal for your health, it'll take a little bit longer to get from here to there. If you're having smoothies rather than hard-boiled eggs or like kale for every meal, if you find that it's sating your hunger, that you actually enjoy it, you're less likely to trip up. And then if you also make these plans and think through like, how will I avoid the temptation so that I'm not encountering donuts in my environment, that may be important too. You may also even want to incentivize yourself, which sounds funny, but you can create what economists call a commitment device, which is basically you acting like a parent normally would to a child, or a teacher would with a student, or an employer would with an employee, and creating deadlines for yourself or rules and even penalties if you fail to achieve goals. So if you're really worried that even with the smoothies, you're still going to be tempted to have the donut and you don't want to let that happen, you can make plans in advance to actually penalize yourself if you give in to that temptation so that it'll be less likely you will. So you can literally fine yourself and choose a referee who will hold you accountable for eating the right meals, and put money on the line that you have to send to a charitable organization, say that you hate. And there are websites like stick.com and beminder.com. And I'm sure there are others. Those are just the ones I happen to know about, where you can literally create these contracts that will ding you if you fail to achieve a goal. So that sometimes you have to up the ante, up the stakes for failure so that your short-term pleasures won't dominate the long-term value.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What is temptation bundling?
I'm so glad you asked, because this is one of my favorite tools for dealing with a situation where what's fun in the short run isn't aligned with what's good for you in the long run. And that's one of the things holding you back from achieving your goals. Temptation bundling is a strategy that involves linking something you love and crave with something that normally feels like a chore, but that you want to do more often, so that you can turn that chore into a source of pleasure. So let me give you a really concrete example to make this come to life. When I was a graduate student and I was procrastinating after a long day of classes on getting my work done, and I could not motivate myself to go to the gym, I always wanted to come home and just binge watch TV. And I created a rule for myself. I would only let myself indulge in entertainment while I was exercising at the gym. And suddenly I'd come home from a long day of classes, and instead of wasting time, I'd head off to the gym. I'd get in a great workout. The time would fly while I was there because I was finding out what happened to my favorite characters in my latest show, or I actually also really love temptation bundling with audiobooks. And then I'd come back to my apartment and I was re-energized, motivated, ready to focus on my work. I'd gotten my entertainment fix in and I'd had this great exercise session. So that's temptation bundling. And you can do it in lots of settings, not just with exercise. You can only let yourself pick up a favorite snack while you're heading to the library to hit the books, or you can reserve favorite podcasts for only while I'm doing household chores, or a favorite bottle of wine you only open if you're cooking a fresh meal for family. So there's lots of different ways we can link something that's a source of instant gratification with something that would otherwise feel like a chore, to give that chore the flavor of fun. And I've done research, and so have others, showing that when you can add that spoonful of sugar that makes the medicine go down, to quote my favorite nanny, Miss Mary Poppins, it turns out to be really effective, whether it's around achieving our exercise goals, our educational goals, you name it. And it comes back to this principle about anything that's not enjoyable in the moment, we tend not to persist on. So once we recognize that about ourselves and can structure our goals in a way that pursuing them aligns with what's fun in the moment, then we get better outcomes.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. So let's talk about gamification for a second, because is it the fun in the gaming strategy or is it the reward? And if it's a reward, what's been your research on fame versus fortune or money versus recognition?
The research on gamification is really mixed on when it works. So it definitely can be effective, but it seems like most of the situations where adding the bells and whistles that make something feel like a game, whether it's you accumulate points and earn prizes and there's a leaderboard and you're competing and you're getting badges and leveling up and there's a prize, those kinds of things do actually seem to improve performance in settings where people are intrinsically motivated to achieve a goal, and it helps align, again, that long-term objective that someone already has with a short-term reward. So think about apps. I'll admit right now I'm really enjoying Duolingo and doing Spanish practice with my son. And we both want to do the Spanish practice. And when it tells us, oh, you have a streak, don't break the streak and you're leveling up and here's your badge, that's towards a goal that we want to achieve. And so the fun is aligned with our mission anyway, and it works. It makes it a little bit more exciting. There's a little extra something enticing us to get that done. And it feels more like a game and more effortless, and it's very effective. But there's research by some of my colleagues at Wharton, Ethan Mollick and Nancy Rothbard, that shows when a game like that is used by an organization that's trying to basically, I don't want to say manipulate, but I'll say urge its employees towards greater productivity, the results are much more mixed. And when they looked at data on a sales force that was where they tried to gamify the job, what they found is that a lot of people found it unfun. It wasn't aligned with an intrinsic goal. People felt like you're trying to create this architecture to just get me to do something I don't particularly want to do. It doesn't feel fun. So I think there's two parts of it. One is there's an art to creating things that are fun. And maybe if your employer could create something truly fun so that your job literally felt like playing Candy Crush all day, then maybe you'd be more productive. But to the extent that it's layered on top, it's not changing the nature of the work. It's just adding bells and whistles so that now you get a leaderboard at the end of the day and you feel compared to all your peers. Unless you're intrinsically motivated, that may feel coercive and unpleasant and actually demotivate you. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind with gamification.
Yeah, it's a really important point. And I was also wondering if games, like you talked about playing the Spanish game with your son, and is it more successful for all or just some demographics? Because I would assume there are people that just are not interested in gamification. And then there's certain demos that would thrive on it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And certainly we know there are certain demographics that love video games, for instance, and others less so. And yeah, teenage boys, I think, are right in that demographic. My son isn't a teenager yet, but sometimes I feel like he is. So yes, it may be the case that but this comes down to the fit and what makes something fun. The idea of gamification is just that you're trying to make something feel more enjoyable and light. And if the way you do that doesn't resonate with the audience that you're trying to hit, then in a sense, it's not even gamification. It's just
annoying.
A bunch of bells and whistles that were useless. Yeah. So it's about finding what makes something fun for a person. And for me, when I was trying to exercise, in a sense, I was gamifying it by making it linked and aligned with indulgent entertainment. But that's fun for me. And what's indulgent, by the way, entertainment for one person, Bridgerton for one person is someone else's poison. I happen to find that very entertaining, but someone else might not. So you have to find the thing that makes it fun for you. And that is really important to all of this. It's, again, it's another form of tailoring that we often overlook. We just try to apply like a single lesson. Oh, gamification, this is going to solve everything. But if it's not well suited to the individual, then it's going to be a flop.
That makes so much sense. So let's talk about each of the main adversaries, procrastination and forgetfulness and laziness and confidence. Let's start with procrastination and how we handcuff ourselves by making commitments that we can't keep.
Yeah, absolutely. Procrastination is a really tough barrier. And again, it's related to present bias, which we've talked about already. And that's the tendency to value what we can get immediately and what will bring us immediate rewards more than delayed rewards. And procrastination is just an implication of that. Because if I always focus more on now than on the later value I can create, I'll always put off until tomorrow what I can that's not fun to do today related to my goals. And so this leads to pile up around deadlines. Like, this is it. I have a very funny graph that I like to show my Wharton MBA students of how many of the submissions for homework assignments arrive within the last 2 hours, even when these assignments have been on the bulletin board for the whole semester. But we all put it off. We'll do it tomorrow. Today I'm going to have fun, or today I'm going to go out with my friends and do something else. So procrastination is a big barrier, and it's related to retirement savings, health outcomes. We always think, tomorrow I'll start eating a healthy diet. Tomorrow I'll start going to the gym. Tomorrow I'll start saving. It's a big problem. And actually, we've been talking a little bit about one of the ways to deal with it, which is if you make it so that there's present value in the activity, now you're not going to procrastinate as much. You can make it more fun. And the flip side, which we briefly touched on, is setting up some constraints for yourself so that there's a real penalty if you don't achieve your goals in a timely manner. And commitment devices are the best tool for dealing with procrastination, using more of a stick rather than carrot approach. The carrot is make it fun. The stick is, what are you going to put on the line that you'll have to forfeit if you don't achieve this by a certain date? So that now you're upping the ante to procrastinating. And if you put it off beyond that, it's worse. So you can do this with money. You can do it with groups of people who hold you accountable. There are various ways you can create some real sting for yourself so that there's an immediate consequence if you don't do the things you need to do. But I think that's really valuable. The other thing that's related to procrastination is breaking down big goals into smaller pieces. And if you have a long-term goal, I hope to go back to Spanish because I was just mentioning my son and I practicing. Say we had the goal of doing 200 hours of Spanish per year. Well, we might say like, we'll do that all in December. But if we break that down into a more bite-sized component, like, oh, I want to do 4 hours a week, suddenly I have a commitment to something that needs to happen in the shorter term. And then now it's harder to procrastinate. And we see that breaking down big goals into component pieces that have an immediate ask of you makes it feel more bite-sized, so it's not as daunting and people are more willing to try, right? If I ask you, do you want to save $5 a day rather than $150 a month? I get something like 5 times as many people saying yes, even though it's literally the same thing, and you get more progress. So there's definitely good things that come from breaking down big goals into more bite-sized components when it comes to procrastination.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of interesting strategies when you're mentioning the sting. But it made me think about behavior modification. And in dog training, a lot of the animal behaviorists say, always be positive in your behavior modification. And have you ever looked at behavior modifications for animals at all? I mean, you mentioned, do you have a dog?
I don't have a dog. That's funny.
But I was just like so curious about that.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. So in terms of behavior modification in humans, the research shows that losses loom larger than gains and are more motivating. So when there's a threat of a loss, it's people throw around different numbers, but maybe roughly twice as motivating as the promise of an equal sized reward in terms of changing behavior. That said, the positive rewards can be important for habituation. There can be value in giving people the sense that there's something positive that's going to come out of this and making them more interested in approaching the goal as opposed to a fear that something negative will come out of it. Negative can come with stigma as well. But when we think about using commitment devices, it's a tool that we're using on ourselves. So that doesn't normally come with stigma. It's different than someone else slapping you or on the hand or fining you in terms of changing behavior. So I think that is an important thing to keep in mind. And again, the research is really quite clear that in general, losses are more motivating than gains, even though they come with some negative consequences.
That's fascinating. Let's talk about the next adversary, which is forgetfulness. And you mentioned cue-based planning, which I found to be so interesting.
Forgetting is a barrier. We forget a lot. We think if it's important to us, of course we'll follow through. But life is busy. There's a lot on most people's plates. And we really do sometimes just forget to follow through on our goals or forget to make time, forget to make it a priority. I've done research that shows that even when there's cash that people can earn from remembering to follow through on things, they'll often say, oh no, I don't want to pay a minimal fee to get a reminder. I'm going to remember to do this. And then if they'd paid the minimal fee, it turns out they would actually have remembered because they would have gotten the reminder. They didn't think they needed it. And so they suboptimized. So we undervalue the importance of reminders. We underappreciate forgetting and how costly it will be. So what can we do about it? Well, there's this really wonderful research by Peter Gulwitzer, who's a professor at NYU in the psychology department, and he's studied the best way to structure our plans so that they'll be memorable and that we'll follow through on them. And the structure he's found the best plans take is a really simple structure where you say, if thing X happens, then I will follow through, then I will execute my plan, as opposed to just, I'm planning to study, I'm planning to go to bed on time, I'm planning to meditate, I'm planning to study Spanish. That's not nearly as effective as if it's 4 p.m. on a Thursday, then I will log in and study Spanish. Or if it's after the last meeting of the day on a weekday, then I will go to the gym. Whatever that if is, it serves as a cue that triggers you to action. So it can be a time, it can be a place. Whenever you pass by this store, you'll always remember to give your mom a ring and check in, see how she's doing. It can be something that happens at a high frequency in your life. When you smell this, when you get this email, whatever it is, you need that if, and it serves as a cue. And the way that our memories are stored is that they're actually cue-based. So a cue will trigger recall. So once you have that if-then plan in place, one, you're going to feel more like you're breaking an official plan. We don't like going back on our own intentions as opposed to just vaguely delaying or procrastinating on doing something. If you don't do it, it's a real serious miss. But also, it's more likely that it'll trigger your memory and you won't just flake out on the activity because now you've maybe you even put it on your calendar once you nail down the exact time and location when you intend to do something. So cue-based plans are really valuable for getting us to follow through on our intentions because they have this memory trigger function and they also make procrastination harder.
My name's Dwayne Osterlin. I'm host of the Addicted Mind podcast. Are you ready to uncover the science of breaking addiction? Then join me on the Addicted Mind, where compassion meets innovation. We're going to explore real stories of addiction recovery, hear from real experts on science-based treatment, and you'll be able to equip yourself with the tools for lasting change. So whether you're on the road to recovery yourself or walking alongside someone who is, the Addicted Mind podcast is your companion. So check it out. Subscribe on whatever podcast app you're using right now and be part of the conversation that's changing lives.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. What's a memory palace?
Yeah, memory palaces are so interesting. And now we're like going way back in time because memory palaces go, this is something that people have been talking about for hundreds of years. The idea of a memory palace is that if you want to embed something firmly in memory, you can do that by creating what researchers call mnemonic devices. And we all like learn these growing up. We learn these little tricks to give us a sense of the order of things or what we need to do. So a memory palace is such a trick. And you can learn to remember up to 10 or 15 items on a list by using this technique. Imagine that you have a list of items you want to remember to pick up at the grocery store. Now, probably you're just going to plug that into your smartphone, but say you don't have a smartphone, you have to remember it. A really effective tool for doing this is closing your eyes and walking through a familiar location, your house, your palace, and you think about the first room you're going to enter, your entryway. And now you have to think, what's the first item on the list you need to remember? Say it's you're going to pick up bananas. Okay, now you imagine your entryway festooned with bananas, like a bizarre scene that will be deeply embedded in memory. And you're like, okay, bananas, entryway of bananas. Okay, now walk into the next room. Maybe now you enter your living room. And the next thing on your list, we need to layer all over your living room. Maybe you need to pick up some Tylenol. Now there's Tylenol bottles everywhere. And you walk around your house and you know the route you're going to take and you stick the items in your list, imagine them all over. And it turns out using this technique of memory palaces, people can remember dramatically more than they'd be able to if they didn't have this sticky association. And essentially those become cues. Each room in the palace is a cue that's triggering the memory. And now you can recall by walking through the palace, something you're very familiar with. Each of those cues will trigger the memory of the thing it is that you wanted to retain. So this is how memory champions, in many cases, store much more information than we can by using cue-based visuals.
That's great. And then you go on to talk about laziness and how humans have this tendency to take the path of least resistance and that we tend to take shortcuts and that can be a problem because we default to the easiest route. What can we do about this?
Yeah, there's really two solutions for this tendency to look for the path of least resistance. The first, and this is the easiest, whenever this works, this is an amazing trick, is to change what the default will be. So the default is like, what happens if you take no other action? So if you're thinking about food, the default is like, what's in my fridge and my pantry? Because if I don't order a meal or go out to the grocery store, this is the stuff that I'm left with to eat. And so it'll be the easiest thing is to grab myself a quick snack out of one of those locations or make myself a meal from what's on hand. So setting good defaults in that respect is that's how that works. Or if you're thinking about, I want to spend less time on social media and more time reading the news, then you could set up your default web page. So when you open your computer and you open a browser, you're going to see the New York Times website instead of Facebook. You get that picture. So you set up your life so the path of least resistance takes you. Maybe you don't buy a car, so you have to walk to work. And now that's the path of least resistance. You can structure your life in a way that defaults are working in your advantage rather than against you if you have certain goals. But not everything can be a default setting that's changed, right? Not everything can be on autopilot. Not everything can be like, oh, I've set up an automatic transfer from my monthly paycheck to my savings account. And now that just happens every month and I don't have to think about it anymore. That's an amazing way, by the way, to save. You do that transfer every month. You never see the money. It just evaporates and it's on forever after. So as many things as you can put on autopilot, the better, but some things can't be put on autopilot, right? You can't automatically shuttle yourself to the gym after work every day. You can't automatically put your brain into meditation mode for an hour every day. So whatever it is that you have goals around that requires active engagement and can't just be passively turned into a default, then that's where we need to build habits. If there are things that you want to put on autopilot in your life, as habits. And the research out there is really clear that there is a formula for this. It's a lot like practicing any other skill. You want to repeat the same activity enough that it starts to become habitual. You want to make sure that you're getting positive reinforcement, feedback, rewards of some kind every time you do it. And ideally, there is a cue that's fairly consistent that triggers the behavior. But my research has actually shown that you don't want to be too rigid about when you engage in a behavior. So if you are trying to become a 9 a.m. meditation person, it's great to try to say that's my regular time. Okay, I'm going to set a reminder. I'm going to put on my calendar. I've made my plan. I'm going to reward myself with a treat after I do it at my favorite coffee shop. Maybe I'll have a friend who's holding me accountable and checking in to see whether or not I've done it. Okay, that's all good. But if you want to form a habit, another thing you have to keep in mind is that life gets in the way. Sometimes if 9 a.m. is your ideal time, you're going to have a meeting at 9 a.m. or you're going to hit traffic on the way to work and you're not going to be able to set aside that particular slot for meditation. And it turns out the best habits, when we're building them, we're actually building them somewhat flexibly so that we have not only a primary plan, but also a backup plan. So that if you miss 9 a.m., you don't say, oh, I can't meditate today. You also, okay, lunch is my backup slot. So we did a large randomized controlled trial with 2,500 Google employees where we were trying to help them build exercise habits. And we found that building habits where people did the behavior 85% of the time in the same time and place was actually less likely to create lasting change than building habits where only half of them were done in the same time and place. And that was because the rigidity of that always being in the same environment led people, they built something of a habit around doing it at that time. But if they missed their regular time, they didn't get around to it at all. And that ended up being harmful for robust behavior change. So it's important when building habits to repeat, to have some consistent reward and consistency around the environment when you're in startup phase, but you also want to build in a little bit of variability. So you always have a backup plan to fall back on if you can't do it in the first best environment.
Flexibility, adaptability with the routine that you create. You talked about the daily meditation routine that you use this as an example. Find the same time and place to routinely meditate. Make it a routine, but be flexible. Reward yourself. Track your efforts. You say that tracking helps you avoid forgetting.
Absolutely.
And habit stacking.
Yeah. So there's only a little bit of research on this, actually, even though it's, I think, very popular idea. But I think the best evidence for this really is related to the idea of a cue-based plan, that if there's something that's a trigger, if there's an if-then component, that can be more effective. There's one study that shows that if people are trying to build a flossing habit, encouraging them to do it right after they brush their teeth can make it more sticky because there's something already that, but I think of that as more cueing. It makes a lot of intuitive sense that you want to put things together, but sometimes it can be harmful if you're trying to stack too many things in a row, because it can be overwhelming. And there's research showing that if you have too much piled on top, too many different plans, that actually can derail you. So it's a popular concept. There's a little bit of evidence for it, but I think the best thing is you want a cue, and that's what's more important rather than all the things I want to do on a daily basis pile on top of each other. Because that can be like, okay, coffee, breakfast, meditation.
That's pressure.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's too much pressure.
But I think the science is still being built for whether or not there's, I worry a little bit that some of the things we've seen suggest that could backfire in some contexts. So be flexible and look for what the cues are. It doesn't necessarily have to be another habit that you're stacking on top of. It could be a time or a place that will trigger the action. And that can be really valuable.
And you said very clear, you said too much rigidity is the enemy of a good habit. So I think that's really important to remember. And then you also talked about how tracking, especially when you're aiming for streaks, which I think you were doing with your Spanish, can really facilitate the habit building.
Yeah, absolutely. If there's something you're afraid to lose, your streak, if you're tracking yourself and you see something that you want to hold on to, that can be motivating because losses loom very large. And so that seems like there's some potential there to use that as another tool. It's a gamification strategy, and it can work for some of us to keep us on track and make us want to keep going.
And the last two adversaries are competence and conformity. I think you had mentioned in the chapter on confidence that self-doubt can be a huge problem in keeping you from making progress.
Yeah. When we don't believe we can achieve our goals, we're not very likely to put an effort towards them. And so having some confidence that you can achieve them is really important. And there's a variety of different ways to instill confidence in yourself or in other people. One of them is just building on work of Carol Dweck, a great psychologist at Stanford University. She's done brilliant research on the importance of having a growth mindset about whatever goal we're pursuing, as opposed to a fixed mindset. So a fixed mindset says, I have limited capacity. It's fixed. I'm born with it. I have it or I don't. And so when I am trying to pursue a goal and I encounter setbacks, I interpret those as diagnostic of, oh, yep, that's just as good as I can get. That's my level. If you have a growth mindset, in contrast, you recognize that in almost everything in the world, there's an opportunity to get better with practice, with effort, through time, that we're on a growth trajectory, whether it's your intelligence, which can grow with effort and learning, or your ability to be a patient parent or a successful lawyer, whatever your goals, you can get better through practice and perseverance. And if you have that growth mindset as opposed to a fixed mindset, then when you encounter any obstacle, right, something goes wrong, you have a failure, you stumble, you don't get where you wanted to get on a certain day, you don't look at that and say, that's just diagnostic, it's who I am. You say, well, how can I learn and grow from this? What does that failure teach me so I can do better the next time? And that turns out to be really important. Trying to adopt a growth mindset can make it easier to build your own confidence, even in the face of inevitable setbacks when you're trying to pursue change. And conformity is related to this when you surround yourself with other people who show you what's possible because they're achieving goals you'd like to achieve and they're maybe a little bit ahead of you on your journey, or at least some of them are, so that you have some role models. That can be really important in building your belief in what's possible. And ideally, they're people who resemble you. They're from your neighborhood. They're people who they're in your age category. If you can find other people who are a little ahead of you on your journey, who you spend time with, you ask them to be mentors, role models, or even just out for coffee, we can learn a lot, both about what's possible, and it can increase our belief in ourselves when we see someone like us succeeding. But also, you can very deliberately try to copy and paste some of the strategies that work for them. And we've done research showing that when you deliberately are told, go try to find someone who's pursuing a similar goal and ask them what's working for them, and you should try to employ the same tactics, literally copy and paste, that gets better results than when people are given advice at random from others, or when they are just told to make their own plans in isolation. So it can be really valuable to build your confidence to go looking for those kinds of role models.
In the very last chapter, you say, by diagnosing the internal obstacles you face and consistently using solutions customized to help you succeed, evidence and experience show that you really can get from where you are to where you want to be. I thought that was such a nice summary. Is there anything else that you want to bring out about the book that we haven't covered? Anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I think one thing that I would love to share that might be a perfect place to wrap is actually that one of my favorite things I've studied related to behavior change is the notion that there are moments in our lives when we feel more open to change than others. And these moments are fairly predictable. They arise whenever we feel like we have a new beginning, a chapter break in our life story. So it might be the start of a new week. That's a minor new beginning, or the start of a new month. Bigger ones might be the celebration of a birthday or the start of a new year, which of course many people use that motivation to set New Year's resolutions, moving to a new community, a new job. These moments that feel like transition points, they give us a sense that we have a clean slate and that we have an identity shift. And whatever we were failing to achieve in life that we'd hoped to do better on, you can say, well, that was the old me, and this is the new me, and the new me is going to be different. So fresh starts are really great opportunities to look for trying to jump in and think about how can you make a positive change in your life. And then you're going to want to set up structures and come up with strategies so that it won't just be all a game of hope. But if you can use those fresh start moments to actually try to deploy some of the tactics we've been talking about, that can be really valuable because of that burst of motivation they provide.
Katie, this is just chock full of great information. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks to Katie for being here today, and to all of our listeners. You can find her amazing book at all major booksellers. If you have comments or suggestions, email us at untangle@choosemuse.com. And don't forget to check out the Muse headband to start or deepen your meditation practice and to sleep more peacefully. Also at choosemuse.com. As always, have a great week, and we will see you next time. We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.